All right. Well, good morning. Good to see everybody here this morning. Do want to welcome our online audience. It is great to have you with us here today. Also want to welcome our Willow locations. A big shout out to Willow North Shore. Great to have you here with us as well. As we continue this series we've been in for, we just started last week called Summer Mixtape. Now, if you're with us last week, you know this series really is looking at some of the shortest books in all of the Bible. There are quite a few books in the Bible that are only made up of one chapter. And so last week we looked at the book called Jude, written by Jude, who was the half-brother of Jesus. Now this week we're going to look at about another New Testament book. It's the New Testament book called Philemon. It wasn't written by Philemon, it was written to Philemon. It was written by the Apostle Paul, who wrote so many different letters to churches and individuals that really makes up the majority of the New Testament of the Bible. Now, Philemon's a very short letter. It's a personal letter. In the English translation, it's 480 words. And so it's very, very short, but yet it is jam-packed. I find it encouraging, inspirational, but if you apply it correctly, I would argue it's one of the most challenging short little letters we have in all the New Testament. So I'm excited to dive in. Now, as I mentioned, it was written by the Apostle Paul. He wrote it while he was in prison, likely in Rome, and he wrote it to Philemon. Now, Philemon was this fairly wealthy guy, as we know, and we know that one of the early churches, one of the churches that Paul originally started, met in Philemon's home. You pick that up at the very beginning of his book, Philemon, verses 1 and 2. It says, "To Philemon, our dear friend and fellow worker, and to the church that meets in your home." Now, I asked the question, which church was it that met in Philemon's home? We don't know for sure, but we think the church at Colossae. Now, maybe you're familiar with the book of Colossians in the New Testament. Likely it was that church that met in Philemon's home. We can even take it one step further, that Paul wrote a lot of the letters that he wrote that are now our New Testament books. He wrote them while he was in prison. The book of Colossians, the letter to the church at Colossae, was one of the ones he also wrote while he was in prison. So it's very, very possible that same messenger that took the book of Colossians from Paul's jail cell to that church was the same messenger that carried this letter to Philemon. Maybe they were even delivered at the same time. And so Philemon might have received this particular letter with the letter to the church at Colossae, the Colossians church, in the messenger's back pocket. They were kind of one in the same. Now, if you look at this letter, it's addressed to Philemon, but it's about a very specific situation that Paul's trying to get at with Philemon. What he mentions is there's this person that Philemon would have known, this guy by the name of Onesimus. Onesimus was a former slave of Philemon. Now, the moment you and I hear the word slave, where we immediately go in our minds are, we go back to our country a few hundred years ago when slavery was a part of our cultural makeup. It was kind of the reality that was demoralizing, dehumanizing. It was when one human being owned the life of another human being. That's not really a good description of what slavery was like in the first century. Though there was something called an indentured servant, but likely that's not what's going on here. More often than not, what slavery was like in the first century was if you had a debt to somebody, you owed them something, you couldn't repay the debt, you would enter into this kind of slave-servanthood relationship because you were allowed to work off your debt. That's how you would take care of this debt that you couldn't pay. And so instead of one human being owning another human being, instead it was oftentimes a mutually agreed upon relationship for a mutually agreed upon specific time. So if I owed you $100,000, it was a debt that I couldn't pay, maybe you and I would make an arrangement that it would take me 7 years to work that off. That was likely the relationship of Philemon and Onesimus. The challenge was that while Onesimus was working off his debt in Philemon's home, he stole something from Philemon and then hightailed it out of town. And he fled not only Philemon because the consequences of his actions of stealing from the person that he was supposed to be working for, he ran to Rome, ends up interacting with Paul while Paul was in prison. And in their interaction, in their time together, by Paul's leadership, Onesimus becomes a follower of Jesus. His life is totally changed, totally transformed. And so what Paul is going to do is to write Philemon to say, hey, this one that owed you something, hey, this one who stole from you, I actually want you to forgive his debts. And so you see it in a couple of verses later. We're going to have some words highlighted. If you can, say those words out loud, full voice. Say it like you mean it. Say it like you believe it. Here's what it says. This is Paul writing. It says, I appeal to you for my son Onesimus, who became my son while I was in chains. Formerly he was useless to you, but now he's become useful both to you and to me. That's actually a play on words. The word Onesimus literally means useful. But Onesimus was far from useful the first time Philemon knew him. He was pretty useless in Philemon's mind. But because of the radical change and transformation he's experienced, he's become a follower of Jesus, Paul says, I'm pretty confident when he comes back to you, he's actually going to be really, really useful. And he says, I want you to cancel his debt. In other words, I want you to forgive him. Now, if you put yourself in Philemon's shoes, that's a difficult thing to hear. Because everything that he had ever known about his interaction with Onesimus has not been really good. He has all kinds of negative thoughts about his interactions with him. I mean, he was trying to create a scenario that he could work off the debt instead of having to, you know, be under the debt in a debt that he couldn't pay. And even in that kind of extension of grace, Onesimus had taken advantage of Philemon. There was likely a lot of bad blood between the two. But in order to kind of take it a step further, Paul actually offers himself as part of the solution. Here's what it says. It's Paul writing. He says, so if you consider me a partner, welcome him as you would welcome me. If he's done you any wrong or owes you anything, charge it to me. Now, what I find very interesting about this short little book called Philemon, it's the only letter Paul ever wrote that he never mentions the resurrection of Jesus. I think that's intentional. Because in a sense, what Paul's doing is he's embodying the resurrection in of himself. He recognizes it was the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus that created the opportunity for you and I to receive forgiveness, for you and I to be set free by what God has done. And so now he's saying, what God has done through Jesus for you, if Onesimus owes you anything, I will pay his debt on his behalf. That's what I'm willing to do. It kind of makes me think of it this way. Again, if you kind of picture the scenario, basically it's this. Onesimus has a debt. He had an IOU to Philemon. He couldn't pay it. And so the relationship was characterized by debt. Again, as I mentioned, not only was there the original debt, but that debt got piled upon when Onesimus stole from him and hightailed it out of time. This picture would have characterized what Onesimus' relationship looked like with Philemon. But Paul writes him and says, I want you to cancel the debt. I want you to forgive him. I can't imagine what that would have been like for Philemon to hear that for the first time, because I don't know what your experience with it is like, but for me, forgiveness doesn't come natural. Forgiveness is actually quite challenging. I sometimes have a hard time forgiving people for the most trivial things. So for example, if I'm in a parking lot and somebody takes my parking space, I mean, I had my blinker on and everything, and then they came in and just took the space. I have a hard time immediately extending forgiveness for that. Or if I'm in a grocery store and I'm in the express checkout line, 10 items or less, and the yoo-hoo in front of me obviously has 14 items in their cart, not that I counted, but I counted. I have a hard time extending forgiveness. I have a hard time extending forgiveness over trivial stuff. Much less the stuff that really, really matters. For some of you, you've been harmed far, far worse than that. You think about some of us grew up in homes where one of our parents left our homes when we were little. And it created all kinds of challenge for us, that they abandoned us, the betrayal that we felt, the emptiness that came along with it, the loss of confidence and seeming self-worth. It's hard to think about what it would look like to forgive them. If a spouse betrays the other spouse, the marriage ultimately falls apart, leaving one spouse just buried under a pile of bills and betrayal. That's a hard thing to consider what it would look like to extend forgiveness. You got a business partner. Things seem to be okay, but the business partner didn't handle things properly. Actually, it was a huge breach of integrity that not only cost you your credibility, it cost you your company. It's hard to just extend forgiveness in situations like that, but I don't know if you've ever thought about forgiveness in this way, but I think in many ways, what forgiveness is, the best explanation I can think of is forgiveness is literally learning to cancel the debt. Now, why do I say cancel a debt? Because more than likely, if you have some sort of broken relationships with someone, it's broken over a debt. They owe you something. It might not be monetary in value, but they owe you something. The hurt, the pain, the struggle, the frustration, the animosity, the desire for revenge oftentimes is connected to that debt. Again, going back to the examples we talked about earlier, if a parent left the household when I was young, there's a debt that exists there. What did they take from us? They took our childhood. They took stability for us as a kid. They took a sense of pride because other parents showed up at the sporting events and the piano recitals, but my parent didn't come. They took some self-confidence. They took self-worth. The reality is there's a debt that exists there. We could walk through other examples, but again, I would say the pain, the frustration, the animosity, the desire for revenge, it gets tied into that debt. And forgiveness is the choice to cancel the debt. Now, let me be clear about what forgiveness is and what forgiveness is not. Let's talk very clearly about what forgiveness is not. Forgiveness is not denying that any wrong was done. In other words, forgiveness doesn't just sweep something under the rug, act like it didn't ever happen in the first place. I would say in order to cancel the debt, you actually have to name the debt. You have to acknowledge it. You have to look it in the face. It's not acting like nothing ever happened. It's actually acknowledging the very thing that happened. Forgiveness doesn't take away the pain of the past. But it does give us a shot and a hope for the future. But forgiveness, again, it's not denying that any wrong was done. Here's the second piece, that forgiveness is not contingent on an apology. This one's a tough one. Sometimes when somebody offends you, they'll own it. They'll apologize for it. And in that scenario, we should offer forgiveness. But many times the person never owns it and never apologizes. We should also extend forgiveness in that situation as well. Forgiveness is not contingent on an apology. Here's the third piece. Forgiveness is not forgetting. Again, sometimes you'll hear the phrase forgive and forget. Forgive and forget. I don't even know if forgetting is possible, nor do I think that it's really healthy. Because we will have the memories. We will remember what's done. And so it's not about forgive and forget. I wonder if the better scenario is forgive and forego. What I mean by that is forgive and forego my right to get revenge. Forgive and forego my desire to get back at you for what you've done for me. Forgive and forego my desire to give you pain for the pain that you've caused me. Forgiveness is not forgetting, it's forgoing. The last piece is very important. Forgiveness is not reconciliation. They're two different things. The reason I say that is I think forgiveness actually only requires one party. It only requires the person who was harmed, the person who was offended. It's up to them to choose whether they choose to extend forgiveness or not. It only requires one person. It doesn't even require an interaction with the person who offended you. It doesn't even require that that person is still living. Forgiveness requires one party. Reconciliation requires both parties working together. Reconciliation requires a heart change and a life change from the offender. It requires somebody who's going to choose to do things differently. A relationship cannot be reconciled. It cannot come back together unless there is change where that offense will not keep happening over and over again. There's a difference between forgiveness and trust. And in some cases, I should forgive, but I should not yet trust because the person is not yet trustworthy. And so it's not as though God's asking us to forgive somebody, invite them back into our life where they can reoffend us over and over and over and over again. There's a difference between forgiveness and reconciliation. So that's what forgiveness is not. Let's talk about what forgiveness is. As I've mentioned a couple times before, I think fundamentally what forgiveness is forgiveness is canceling the debt. It's saying that there's a debt in our relationship. There's something you've done. You've harmed me. You've wounded me. My life is in a lot of pain, and I'm going to choose to cancel the debt. Though you may not deserve it, though you may not have earned it, I'm going to choose to cancel the debt and send the relationship back to a neutral perspective. That though I have every right to get back at you, I'm choosing not to. Though I have every right to seek out revenge, I'm choosing not to. I cancel the debt. That's what forgiveness is. I would take it a step further. I would also say forgiveness is often ongoing, meaning it's not a one-time decision. I don't know about you, but there are people in my life that I have forgiven before, and fast forward a month, 2 months down the line, I think about them again, and I can spiral again, thinking about all the things that have happened. And so forgiveness does start with a one-time decision, but oftentimes it needs to be exercised a second, a third, a fourth, a 700th time, right? That it's an ongoing type of thing. Here's the third thing that forgiveness is. This was challenging. You ready for it? Somebody's ready for it. Forgiveness is wanting good in the life of the person who's harmed you. That's hard, isn't it? But here's why that matters. It is virtually impossible to pray for the good of somebody and hold on to anger and bitterness about the same person. And if forgiveness is now wanting good and praying for good in somebody else's life, what ends up happening is it releases my heart from the bitterness that can consume me, and I actually experience freedom. What's fascinating thing about forgiveness is sometimes we think about forgiveness as freeing the other person, but in fact, it actually frees us in the process. That's fundamentally what forgiveness is and what forgiveness is all about. The question becomes, how in the world do we do that? I don't know about you, but that doesn't come easy. If it's hard enough about somebody taking my parking spot, it is a whole different ballgame when it comes to stuff that really matters. Where do we muster up what we need to do to even begin to think about that kind of forgiveness? My challenge to you is it doesn't start with you. It never has. It actually starts with what God has already done for you. The truth is, what we just described here is what God has already done. The truth is, you and I had an IOU with God. Because of our sin, we found ourselves in a position that we were in debt to God with a debt that we could not repay on our own. And what would characterize our relationship is one that we were in debt to God. We were buried in our debt to God. We couldn't get out from under our debt to God. We weren't capable of it. It wasn't possible. This was going to be our reality unless the one who was offended, God himself, chose to do something about it. That's pretty unfair. God wasn't the one who did wrong. God was the one who was wrong, but yet God was the one who chose to do something about it. He chose to send his son Jesus into the world, and by sending his son Jesus into the world to take on the sin of the world, to take on the debt, he eradicated it from your life and from mine. The beautiful thing about what God did in Jesus is God made things right by freeing us from the debt. And so the beauty of that is here's what that means, is what God says when it comes to forgiveness. He says, I don't want you to do unto others as they have done to you. Instead, I want you to do unto others what I have done for you. I don't want you to do unto others what they deserve. I want you to do unto others what I have done. The most kind of crystal clear perspective of this comes from a different place that Paul was writing the book of Ephesians. Help me out with the highlighted words. This is Paul writing again. He says, be kind and compassionate to one another, forgiving each other just as Christ God forgave you. The just as is the most important two words in the verse. That we can only forgive because we are forgiven. I will go as far to say this. It's impossible to be a forgiving person until you fully embrace that you're a forgiven person. Can I let that just sink in for a minute? It's impossible to be a forgiving person until you fully embrace and recognize that by God's grace, you are a forgiven person. We do unto others what God has already done for us in Jesus. It doesn't start with us. It all starts with Him. Now, if that wasn't challenging enough, although I know it is very challenging, if that wasn't challenging enough, in Paul's letter to Philemon, he takes it up a notch. And you're like, Paul, what you said already is already giving me a headache, and I don't know that I'm gonna be asleep tonight. And yet, nevertheless, Paul takes it another step forward in his relationship with Philemon. Here's what he says. He says, perhaps the reason, help me out with the highlighted words, perhaps the reason he was separated from you for a little while was that you might have him back forever, no longer as a, but better than a slave, as a dear. Here's what Paul's saying. I don't want you to just forgive him. I don't want you to just be in a place where forgiveness happens. I want you to take it to a whole nother level. Because here's what happens. Forgiveness sets the relationship neutral. But notice what Paul says. I want you to welcome him back, but I don't want you to welcome him back in the way that he left you. I want you to welcome him back better than when he left you. And what we call that, my friends, we call that grace. And I think it's grace upon grace. Grace literally means unmerited favor. He was once a slave in Philemon's household. He'd done nothing but wrong. And Paul wants not only the wrong to be eradicated, but when he comes back, to be given favor that he didn't even have before the wrong was done. Now, that's kind of a head scratcher a little bit, but again, it draws on what God has already done for us. When God forgives us, maybe that creates a neutrality in our relationship with Him. But when God gives us grace, when God gives us favor, He calls us His sons and daughters. He gives us a whole new level of status in His kingdom because of Jesus. I think it's the picture of reconciliation. I mentioned earlier the difference between forgiveness and reconciliation. This is the picture of it. Reconciliation requires both parties participate. The only way this was possible is because Onesimus, under Paul's direction, became a Christ follower, and Paul's convinced that his life has changed, that he's coming back with a changed heart. He's coming back with changed actions. If he was coming back the same old knucklehead who left Philemon's household, this is not possible. But if he really has had a change of heart, a change in perspective, a change in life, this is what a reconciled relationship looks like. Here's the truth about you and God. God's forgiveness is free to you in Jesus. Reconciliation to God requires you to participate. When God changes your heart, when God changes your life, it creates the opportunity for us to be rejoined with God, reconciled relationally with Him. We don't have to live estranged from God. We can live like this with God. And when given the right possibility, we can live like this with others as well. I remember years ago, and it was many, many years ago, I was preparing a message that I was going to deliver to church. And that particular message that I was preparing for was one on a guy by the name of Jonah. Maybe you've heard of him in the Bible. And Jonah was a guy that God asked to go to this city called Nineveh. It was kind of this wicked city. And he asked Jonah to go to be the carrier of his good news and grace to share that with the city of Nineveh. And Jonah's like, I'm not doing that. Peace out, God. I'm out of here. And he flees from God. He ends up in the belly of the fish. And if you can go back and read the story, there's a book that's titled Jonah. It's named after this particular guy. And I remember preparing this particular sermon, and I remember working on it. I was asking the question to myself, like, who are our Ninevites? Like, who are the people? We don't mind if they receive God's grace. We would just rather not be the ones who carry it to them. And I remember I was going to ask that question as a part of that message. And oftentimes what I do when I'm preparing a message is the questions that I'm going to ask of a church, I ask myself. Because I want to always allow God to do a work in me before he ever tries to do a work in others through me. And so I started asking that question, God, who are my Ninevites? And I remember in this, like, candidly, this self-righteous, arrogant prayer moment with God where I started thanking him, God, thank you that I don't have any Ninevites. Thank you that I kind of got it all together. And I didn't get too far in the prayer where I felt like God said, not so fast, pastor boy. He calls me that when I get out of line. And he's like, not so fast. And he immediately brought to mind something that I hadn't thought about in quite some time. It was about 6 months before this message that Lindsay and I were at home with our two young boys at the time that our home was broken into. And I don't know if you've ever had this experience, but it's incredibly fear-filling, pretty violating experience. And I remember coming downstairs the next morning, and it was very, very clear that somebody had been in our home. There were some things that were gone. But I remember as a father, my heart racing because my two kids were there. And did anything happen to my kids? I remember calling the police. You know, they came over. They did the report. I'll never forget the officer who says, we're probably never going to catch these guys. And I'm like, bro, would you just lie to me? Like, would you tell me you're going to do everything in your power, even if you don't get them? Would you just at least give me a little bit more confidence, right? Well, what I didn't know is we would be the first of this string of residential burglaries that happened in our neighborhood. There were probably 7 or 8 burglaries that happened over the next couple weeks. And eventually these knuckleheads, they didn't make smart moves. And so the cops were able to apprehend them. And so in pretty short order, I had names and faces connected to the people who were in my home. They actually recovered some of the stuff that was stolen from my house. Now thankfully and candidly, I was just grateful that they weren't gonna do this anymore. I was grateful that they were off the streets, you know, that kind of thing. And so I hadn't really thought really much about it. But let's go back to the moment that I'm preparing the message. And I was asking that question, God, who are my Ninevites? And it's almost like God brought these guys to my mind. And I'm like, oh, come on, God. Like, I don't mind that God, you share your grace with them. I just don't wanna be the guy that shares it with them. I mean, you can send anybody, God. Why don't you choose somebody different? Why would you ask me to go? But I could not shake it. I couldn't sleep at night. You know, sometimes when we think about disobedience for God, we think about it in terms of like us doing something bad. This was one of those moments that I felt like if I did not go to the jail cell to visit this one individual, I felt like it would be disobedient to God. And I wrestle with it. I struggle with it. I thought of every imaginable excuse of why I didn't want to go do what I really felt God was asking me to do. I remember the day came. It was a Thursday morning. It was a really cool morning here in Chicagoland. I got in my car. It was about a 30-minute drive from where I lived at the time to this jail cell. And I remember thinking about anything and everything possible that can maybe get me out of doing what I was about to do. I remember arriving at the jail. I sat in my car for another 30 minutes because I didn't want to get out of the car. And frankly, I didn't know what I was going to say. They wouldn't know who I was. They'd never seen me. And so like, what was I even going to say? What was I even going to do? But eventually, God gave me the courage and I got out of my car and I walked into that jail. I identified myself to the officer at the jail as a pastor because I know as a pastor, I can get in to see anybody even if I'm not on their visitation list. And so I told him the person that I wanted to see. I let him know that I was a pastor, and he kind of scratched his head. He's like, all right. And so he went and got the gentleman, and I remember signing the visitation book. He had been there for 6 months. I was the first name on the register. I was the first person to go see him. And before I ever went into that cell, God reminded me, this kid's got nothing. And so I remember going in, and I prepared what I was going to say about 10 seconds. And then I was like, after I say this, I don't know what else to say. And I remember walking into that jail cell, and I remember looking at him, and he was so confused because he didn't know who I was. And I remember just saying, hey, I know you don't know me. My name is Sean. I'm a pastor in the area. I know a little about your story. And I just felt compelled to come here to tell you that God loves you. And God's not done with your life yet. He looked at me and kind of confused. He goes, thanks. I'm like, okay, God, I don't know what to say now. And so I just started asking him questions about his life, his story, a little bit about his family. And I realized that he had nobody. And I found myself, my heart beginning to bend toward his. I found compassion coming up into my heart. And I realized why God asked me to go. There was nobody else going to him. And as a pastor, I could get in to see him. I understood a little bit more why God was asking me to do what God was asking me to do. And so we started talking about all kinds of different things. I started talking about new opportunities and new chances, things like that. And at some point in the conversation, I kind of felt God's nudge going, Sean, you got to tell him who you really are. I'm like, no, I think we're doing all right, God. I don't know. I don't really need to know. He's like, you need to tell him who you really are. And so I said this young man's name. And I said, I think I need to be a little bit more honest with you. I know that part of the reason you're being held here is for some residential burglaries. And I need to be honest enough to let you know that I'm actually one of those homeowners. And I just want you to know that I forgive you. His demeanor immediately changed. He goes, are you the second house on Furlong Street? I'm like, that's a little creepy that you still remember this, but yeah, that's me. He didn't know what to say, so there was a long, awkward silence, and he eventually just goes, I'm sorry. And I said, I didn't come here for an apology. Genuinely, that's not why I'm here. But I am grateful for your apology. That means a lot to me. And I want you to know that I forgive you. And again, it got us talking a lot about second chances, and it got us talking a lot about new opportunities. And I felt God like nudge me again, goes, Sean, don't talk to him about a second chance. You got to be a second chance. I'm like, God, would you leave me alone? It was almost like God was asking me to do this. It's not just about eradicating his debt. Would you put him in a position of grace? And so I remember looking at him through that glass, and I said, you know, the first time you came into my home, you came in uninvited. But when you get out of this place, I want to invite you back to my home, this time by my invitation. I want to invite you to dinner with my family. Now, two things there. One is, I should have talked to my wife about that first. The second is, we actually ended up moved out of state prior to him getting out of jail. He got out of jail when we lived out of state. We've not yet lived that out. But I can't tell you how it changed the dynamic of the conversation, the relationship. That was the first of probably dozens of times that I journeyed back to that jail cell where God formed what I would call the most unlikely friendship. Beautiful friendship. Now, I think back to that story and I think back to that moment. Sometimes I'll share that story with people and people will say, man, that's really cool what you did for that kid, Sean. I genuinely don't see it that way. I genuinely see it as about what that kid did for me. Lewis Smedes says this about forgiveness. Forgiveness is learning to set the prisoner free only to discover that prisoner was me. Forgiveness is not just designed to set the heart free of the offender. Forgiveness is designed to set our hearts free. Where bitterness doesn't win the day, revenge doesn't win the day, animosity doesn't win the day, the things that can consume us and destroy us don't win the day. Grace can set you free. Grace will set you free. I don't know where you're at in your journey. For some of you, you still may be wondering how in the heck you showed up at a church on a Sunday morning. If that's you, I just want you to know more than anything, we're just so glad you're here. No matter where you're at in your spiritual journey, thanks for your trust and your willingness to just show up here. And I want you to know about a God who radically, radically loves you. That you feel like you don't understand how much I've done to God. You don't understand how much debt I have in my relationship with God. Here's what I know. God's capacity of forgiveness is infinitely greater than my capacity to sin. That's true for you as well. And for some of you, God, I believe, brought you here in this moment today to yield your life to Him for the first time. There is forgiveness in God. There is grace in Jesus. When you receive it, truly receive it, it changes everything. For others of you, you've received that grace. You've been changed by it. And there's a call on our life to take what we've been forgiven, take what we've been given, and extend it to the lives of others. To choose to be a people who cancel debts and, when appropriate, are willing to give grace. I know this is a heavy, heavy message for some. If you allow me to, I'd love to pray for you and pray for what God desires to do in and through your story. God, we come before you. We say thanks. God, you're a good, good God. Despite our failings and our failures, God, we believe that you're a God who responds, who's gracious, who forgives in ways that are hard to understand, gives favor. God, for those of us who need to receive that from you, God, might we receive that today. God, for others of us that need to extend that to others, might we at least take a step in that direction today. God, we love you. We say thanks in Jesus' name. Amen.